This is the state of things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. The presidential election we've been talking about for months and months is finally here. But 2020 is more than just an election year. It's the start of a brand new decade. So what will all of this mean for politics? As Congress gears up for November, lawmakers are also preparing for an impeachment trial. And the Democratic presidential field continues to shrink and get whiter. Here in North Carolina, we also have some big elections coming up. Voters will decide a Senate seat and a governorship, as well as all the U.S. House districts, including three with no incumbent. We will talk about all of that and more today with a roundtable of political analysts from around the state. Michael Bitzer is a professor of politics and history at Catawba College. Deandra Rose is a professor of public policy and political science. She's also the director of research in the Center for Political Leadership, Innovation, and Service in the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Susan Roberts is a professor of political science at Davidson College, and Carrie Haney is a professor of political science and African and African American studies at Duke University. Welcome back to all of you. Happy New Year. Good to have you back together.
Happy New Year. Happy to be here.
Thanks so much.
Happy New Year.
Thank you.
So, Carrie, I want to start with you with the latest news here in North Carolina. A federal judge recently blocked the state's voter ID law, at least for now. This is the latest tick in a years-long effort by state lawmakers to establish voter ID in this state. The Supreme Court initially struck down Republican lawmakers' first attempt in 2013. This most recent attempt was passed in 2018 after voters approved a voter ID amendment to the state constitution. So put this in context for us in terms of the impact that you think this may have in North Carolina on the elections.
Yeah, it's fascinating here in North Carolina that we're going into an election year in which the courts will play a major role in the decision you just mentioned, the voter ID issue, where a judge has decided that race was a factor in this decision to require voter ID, and has said that's impermissible. It's going to be a challenge. I understand that the attorney general, a Democratic attorney general, is going to challenge, in part, that decision, not the requirement that there be not have a photo ID, but the decision that voters have some type of ID will be challenged by the attorney general.
Right. So at this point, we know that likely no ID will be needed for the March primaries, but it's still to be determined what may be needed for the November election.
Yes. And the North Carolina ID law is one of the more liberal ones in terms of not having restrictions that are hard to overcome. But nevertheless, they put additional impediments before voters, additional requirements, and without justification as to why we need that. There's very little evidence that there's voter fraud of the type that IDs would prevent. So why have them at all?
So, Michael Bitzer, I want to move over to you and talk a bit about this. The efforts to fight voter ID and arguments from the NAACP and voting rights advocates have long emphasized that voter ID laws do create obstacles for poor voters of color. So do we have any numbers on how this specific version of the voter ID that would have been in play in North Carolina may have affected turnout?
I don't think we do have those numbers because the law hasn't been implemented. So we really don't have a test case as to how this particular voter ID law, as Carrie indicated, a very liberal voter ID law, would have an impact. You know, typically we tend to see in the research that voter ID laws tend to disproportionately affect those of lower income, typically of minority communities. But it's really, we don't have the numbers here in North Carolina to I think, accurately determine whether this kind of liberal ID law would have that great of an impact and who it would disproportionately affect.
Well, Susan, there have been some really close elections in North Carolina history. Looking back to 2016, Roy Cooper won the race for governor by some 11,000 votes. So can you talk about the impact of these kind of laws on these close races and what you are thinking in terms of how this could shape
North
Carolina?
Well, I can definitely say that I do think these laws will have an impact on voter turnout. And that's simply because it's confusing. Mm-hmm. And I think North Carolinians have gone through redistricting cases and confusion. And I think that's going to have an impact, even though that is just anecdotal on my part. I think that As Michael has pointed out in other things, that other articles, that voters do tend to vote straight ticket. And so when you come out and you vote, you're not going to switch parties. You're going to go right down the line, and you're going to be confused as to what district you're in. I have colleagues who have said, now, I'm in the 9th now or the 12th.
Mm.
And I really think that's the impact.
Yeah. Well, Deandra, let's talk about that. I mean, the big story of last year in North Carolina was redistricting.
Mm-hmm.
The General Assembly was forced to redraw both congressional and state maps due to rulings that existing maps were unconstitutional partisan gerrymanders. So talk about the impact that that has, as well as this new voter ID law, on this question that Susan raised of, as a voter, what do I need to know to be ready for this election?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that this represents a really important move toward ensuring that North Carolina voters can elect their preferred representatives and not the reverse of politicians actually picking their constituents. And so, you know, it's interesting to point out that in the 2012 election, 51% of North Carolinians cast their votes for Democrats, and yet Democrats walked away with only 3 out of the state's 13 U.S. House seats. And so we're going to see, with these new maps, a congressional delegation that more closely reflects the political divide or division in the state. Again, it's not a perfect reflection, and we're likely to see the state pick up one additional congressional seat after the 2020 census. And given the fact that North Carolina continues to raise in terms of population, we might see that continue even down to the 2030 census. So, you know, for me, I think that North Carolina already gets a lot of attention nationally when it comes to what's going on in our state. And with this shift in political representation in the House, we're going to get even more attention and we'll wield even more influence over presidential elections.
Well, Michael, talk about that. I mean, we have 3 open seats now. We have Republicans George Holding and Mark Walker, who have said they're not going to run after this redraw. Mark Meadows also is retiring, not due to the redraw, he says, due to wanting to work for Trump more closely. But talk about how the kind of impact redistricting will have on this year's elections. Major shakeup for the congressional map.
Yeah, I think the congressional map certainly, you know, it looks like from all accounts, Democrats will pick up 2 additional seats, one that is based around Greensboro and Winston-Salem in particular, and another one there near Wake County. And I think for the average North Carolina voter, most of all of these seats are relatively safe to one party over the other. So the real battle, in my mind, is going to be for the March 3rd primary, when you will see a slew of Democrats vying for open seats that lean Democratic in the district. And for someone like Mark Meadows' seat, you've got a slew of Republicans seeking that seat as well. So, you know, once we get past March, I think the general election may be kind of the afterthought when it comes to the congressional maps, just simply because of the way that the maps still reflect a kind of solid Democratic base for 5 of the seats, and the remaining seats tend to be very Republican.
Susan, is there anything of note about the redraw of the state maps that stands out for you?
Well, I think I want to point out a shameless plug. Michael Bitzer has a contract to do a book on redistricting in North Carolina. So he is clearly the expert, but I think we have to look at, there's still it's still synonymous that redistricting is gerrymandering, and that you still look at ballot protection versus voter suppression. And I think with redistricting, you're still going to have that interplay of who am I voting for, and as Deandra said, is my vote valid? And with the new seat that's going to be allocated in reapportionment, it'll be reshuffling all over again.
And remember, these maps are only going to be for basically the 2020
sure.
election.
Right.
We're go through redistricting again next year. So this will continue, as Susan pointed out, the confused state of the average North Carolina voter is going to be at least for another year, 2 years.
Well, Carrie, I want to end this segment with you. And this question that has been raised about what constitutes a fair district. Is it fair if it's more competitive? Is it fair if it's more representational? What do you make of this redraw in terms of the question of fairness? Do you think we still have a long ways to go to have fair districts in North Carolina?
I think we do. And it's interesting. The courts have never really decided. And I think they're headed in towards a decision on whether you can have districts that benefit the parties intentionally. and whether that is fair, given that there is a correlation between party and race in this country, that when you talk about drawing districts based on party, we also tend to be talking about drawing districts based on race. So the courts have to decide what is fair in that context and given those facts.
So I want to talk now briefly about the international news of the morning. Overnight, an American drone strike targeted and killed Major General Qassem Soleimani, a very prominent Iranian figure. President Trump ordered the airstrike without official consultation with Congress. And I know that none of you are officially foreign policy experts, but I'm curious to hear a bit about your take on this, both from a strategy perspective as well as any thoughts you have on the impact it may have as we lead into this election year. Carrie, let's start with you.
Yes, you know, it's sad and troubling that we need to talk about this and think about this in terms of politics, given the loss of life and the potential for more loss of life. But this president and this administration has a deficit when it comes to credibility. I think that's widely acknowledged and understood. So we have to think in terms of, is there a political motive behind this, especially given that the congressional leadership, at least on the Democratic side, was not consulted, and especially the Speaker of the House. The Speaker is more than a partisan figure. Constitutionally, the Speaker is second in the line of succession. So one would think if there was something serious in terms of foreign policy that needed to be handled right away, that the Speaker would have been consulted. So we're now in this position of having to second-guess the president in a very serious situation, and that's troubling for me.
Susan, how about you? We've heard a little bit of response from the North Carolina congressional delegation. I know David Price has responded saying that he is concerned that he and his cohort were not consulted with. What do you make of Trump's actions?
Well, I think they're correct. But when I teach the presidency, one of the things that we discuss is how important is a president's management style? How does a president receive, process, and implement information? And I think given what we've seen about Trump's modus operandi to date, we want to know who's talking to him, who's he talking to, is a reaction to an accusation that he's a Twitter tiger. Foreign policy is one that it is, you know, there are politics involved, but this is international. When the newscasters this morning used words like seismic, unprecedented, I don't know how to get into that, although it's a very tenuous situation. But I do think we need to look at how is Trump making this decision and who is he listening to, if anybody.
Yeah, Michael Bitzer, what's your take? I mean, Trump has a fiercely loyal base. They haven't changed their mind much on him, kind of no matter what. Do you think that this is going to have any ramifications for him in terms of electability and moving into the election, positive or negative?
Well, I think the only prediction that I would make is the next 11 months are going to be unpredictable. And mm-hmm. I think throwing this issue into the mix certainly is going to raise questions about, okay, what is Iran's next move? And then what potentially could be the American response to the Iranian response? So we are really into uncharted territory, both foreign policy and domestic policy. We've never had a president who is seeking re-election to be impeached in that same year that he is seeking re-election. So much of this, I think, the only prediction that I would make is, as you indicated, the partisan lenses of both political parties' bases will see this through their particular ideological partisan perspective. Democrats are going to come out and question why the Gang of Eight were not consulted. They will probably get the briefing today from the administration, but Republicans will say, see, this was President Trump being decisive and forward acting in terms of the attack on the embassy. I think both camps are solidified within their particular perspectives, and that's really going to drive a lot of the discussion, whether it's foreign policy or domestic policy, moving into November.
But, Mike, let me ask this question. Isn't this somewhat new, and this is what concerns me? In the past, we've had incidents like this, and there's been a rallying around the flag across party lines. And now we have a situation, I think you're right, that the Democrats are going to move into their camp, the Republicans will stay in their camp, and view this in different ways, and that's troubling.
It is, because of the polarization that we see in our partisanship. I mean, I think, you know, the aspect that I'm going to be most fearful about is I'm not necessarily, this is the average voter, I'm not necessarily voting for my candidate, I'm voting against someone. And I think we saw that particularly in 2016, and we will see it again this year. This notion of polarization is just embedded in our politics and frames so much of the way people look at things that we really can't have really heartfelt discussions about issues like, should we be in a proxy war with Iran?
Well, Deandre, I know you think so much about party identity and how it has become almost just as important as race and gender and and other ways that people identify themselves. Mm-hmm. Talk about how what you're seeing in terms of people's attachment to party identity in this moment.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we talk a lot about identity politics right now, and typically that refers to our willingness to think seriously about demographic factors like age, race, socioeconomic status, gender identity, sexual orientation, and so forth. I think increasingly people are adhering to their party identifications in a similar way. And so I think when we interpret Iran or impeachment, for example, we're likely to see those events and issues emerge as really powerful talking points for both sides of the aisle during this upcoming election. And so I think for Republicans, we're going to see a lot of the president's base dig in and view impeachment, for example, as, you know, just a corrupt political system coming after a decisive leader. I think on the left, we're going to see Democrats frame impeachment as, a strong signal that it's time to right the ship of state and to remove a woefully inept person from the position of leadership and power. And so I think we're going to see that touch every single race from the top of the ticket all the way down to the local elections.
Yeah. Well, Susan, as we're talking about 2020, the recent update yesterday, former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro dropping out of the race. He was the only Latinx candidate. So what do you see as the Democratic Party strategy moving forward, having gone from a really diverse primary candidacy pool to a less diverse one now, candidates kind of trying to position themselves in opposition to President Trump? Talk about Democratic strategy from your point of view.
Well, I think the Democrats have to look at how they brand themselves. Are they going to be, what are the fault lines? Are they going to be more pragmatic in terms of Nancy Pelosi really, not rushing into the impeachment, or a Representative Octavia Cortez in terms of it's not about pragmatism, it's about principle? We've got to go beyond it's anti-Trump if you were speaking for the Democrats. And I think one of the things we shouldn't lose track of is that the Democratic Party can do all it wants to brand itself. What may be more important is how the Republicans brand the Democrats. Are they going to call them socialist, the squad, politically motivated, destroying democracy, anti-Israel? I mean, what can the Republicans do to look at this this group of persons that they see as destructive to democracy, a coastal elite? So I think that when we look at what the Democratic Party can do, it's going to be about what the issues are. But the Democrats are going to have to carry their brand with whoever the Democrats nominate. And I think we've seen people fall out from the race. It's just not time. I don't have the money. My campaign is not working. And so I think there are a lot of mechanical things, logistical things that are winnowing the field.
Carrie, what's your take on mobilizing the Democratic base? Because we know in 2016, a lot of Democrats did not show up and they didn't vote, and that had a severe impact on Hillary Clinton. What will it take for that cohort of voters to show up at the polls this year? Do you think the past 4 years will ensure that they'll show up no matter what? Or do you think the Democratic Party has to do more mobilization?
I think one of the lessons coming from 2016 for the Democrats is that you can't assume that they'll just show up. The Democratic Party has to get out and mobilize key elements of its base. And in particular, related to the question you asked about the top tier of the presidential candidates on the Democratic side, the Democrats should be concerned about the lack of diversity, because they have to mobilize and have enthusiasm among African-American, Latino voters going into November, the November election. And if these groups are not enthusiastic, that's trouble for the Democratic Party. They need to turn these voters out in high numbers and they need to worry about whether or not what their image of the party is, given that the top tier candidates, there's no racial ethnic diversity.
How about on the state level, Michael Bitzer, in terms of turnout for the governor's race and the senator's race? What are you looking at in terms of party strategy there?
I think certainly all of this is going to be dependent on the top of the ticket. You know, the presidential race is going to subsume so much. But, you know, for the U.S. Senate, I would expect maybe $100 million plus being pumped into this race. For the governor's race, probably well over $80 million. And people are going to be just inundated. The average voter probably is going to see the campaign ads, be reached out by the campaigns, because now it's all about mobilization of a base, and there is such a small sliver, maybe 10, 15, maybe 20% of the electorate, if that high, that is persuadable, that could go one way or the other. And I think turnout is going to be huge, because what we're seeing in some of the polls right now are that voter interest is at an all-time high, and we're 11 months out from the election. There was one prominent Democratic strategist that I heard say, we could easily see 70% voter turnout among registered voters. He's could potentially see 80%. That's just huge in terms of the level of interest that's already there on both sides, but you're talking about whether the bases show up and how persuadable is that small sliver of the middle of the electorate.
Deandra, how about younger voters? I saw a statistic recently that nearly 40% of the electorate in 2020 will be millennial or Gen Z voters, so potentially could have a major impact. As someone on the college campus, what are you hearing from these younger generations about their motivations to get to the ballot box?
Oh my gosh, I think this, in terms of political socialization, this particular political moment and historical moment is a really fascinating one for people who are coming of age and really moving into their roles as citizens. And in North Carolina, for example, we're seeing college campuses really lean into their capacity to help facilitate voter access. And so we have, for example, the Carolina Challenge, where a number of North Carolina's colleges are actually competing to see which school can increase its voter turnout on campus by the greatest amount. And so we're seeing a lot of energy from young people. And I expect to see that after the midterm election and that, you know, unprecedented level of participation, we're going to see that continue in 2020.
Susan, how about you? What are you hearing from students in your classes about what it would take for them to get to the polls and the issues that matter most to them at this moment?
Well, I think I echo that now college campuses and students are looking at things that matter in the very fundamental sense. They're not saying, who are you going to vote for? I like this candidate. I mean, they're doing that, of course, but they're looking at the mechanics. You can't vote if you're not registered, turning out the vote, and trying to replicate what happened in 2018 in terms of a large turnout by the cohort that typically does not turn out. And we're going to have to transition from talking about the millennials to Generation Z. And these are people that have grown up on their mobile devices. And I think they'll use those in terms of ways to generate activism on campus. I think that this is one of the things that students are concerned about, the process and not necessarily the person. There may be, in some college campuses, an anti-Trump motivator, but there also are some people that on the other side that see the more conservative students that I think are just as likely to want to find a voice. But I think the process is where we're seeing young people get involved, and that's really fundamental to the democracy.
Michael Bitzer, do you think the Democrats and Republicans have good strategies for mobilizing young voters at this moment, both nationally and here in North Carolina?
Yeah, I think if you look at the national numbers, the national trend is that anybody under the age of 40, and we're talking about millennials and Gen Z, tend to be a center-left generations, as opposed to baby boomers who tend to be a center-right. And here in North Carolina, I think the strategy is 35% of the electorate right now of registered voters in North Carolina, 35% of them are under the age of 40. And so this year's election is going to be what I describe as a tectonic shift. If both parties can mobilize, energize, and get those younger voters out in terms of November's elections. I think that's going to be the real question. And if that does happen, it's interesting to see how the dynamics of the national numbers, if it plays out here in North Carolina and we are a reflection of the national trends, does that then shift the state from a center-right to potentially a truly competitive or slightly lean center-left kind of a state? I think that's all the unknowns, but the campaigns are certainly going to be working on that in terms of their fundamental strategies.
Anita, I might add, too, that it's going to depend a lot on who the candidate is. There have been articles about Buttigieg not really appealing to the younger voter.
But Bernie Sanders is.
And that's because maybe Mayor Pete is moderate, but also there's been material written that says they don't want to have someone else claim their ideology. They want to speak for themselves. And I think that turnout and the enthusiasm gap has to be met by voters who might, young voters who may say, okay, I don't agree with Joe Biden, but I've got to be pragmatic. And I think it's the pragmatism and the principle that may make for the turnout and the voting. But definitely the demographics have to be really considered by the Democrats and not ignored. And we've got to see if people want and if they think it's even possible to defeat Donald Trump. That's what they have to see as a pathway to victory for voters to turn out.
Yeah, and one of the things I'm noticing with my students at Duke and elsewhere when I travel is an interest in issues. Environmental concerns is one that is motivating students in ways that we haven't seen before. So you add that on top of the personalities and who the candidate might be for the Democrats. They're focusing on issues, and that's going to be important moving into November, what the issues are and which candidate and which party is moving the issues that they care most about.
Right. Deandra? Mm-hmm.
I'd agree. So I just wanted to tag on that education is one of the most centrally important issues for my students, thinking especially about staggering student loan debt and the cost of college, you know, in addition to environmental issues and immigration, I think are really important to students right now.
We don't have a lot of time left, but I want to end getting each of your take on the biggest trend of the decade. We're going to look back briefly and just kind of paint a picture of what you think was either a really significant moment or a really powerful force as we look back at the past 10 years. Michael, let's start with you.
For me, I think it's not just the generational cohort and the dynamics there, but the urban, suburban, rural divide, particularly here in North Carolina. I think that's going to continue to play out and shape the dynamics of this state moving forward.
Susan?
I'm looking at activism, where we've changed from maybe checkbook activism, credit card activism, that's still important post-Citizens United, which is a big force from the last decade. But we get to hashtag activism and just activism itself when we look at hashtag Ferguson, hashtag Me Too, if we look at the origins and the activism of Black Lives Matter, the Women's March, the Moral Majority, the Moral Monday, the March for Our Lives. And I think that is one of the things that will propel and will continue, that money's still important. The super PACs are still important, but people are really participating with their feet and not just the donations they make to campaigns. So it's hashtag activism, activism in general.
Deandra?
For me, it's what it means to have access to political office, what it means to be able to run for office. President Trump as an unconventional candidate, and then in the wake of his election, the election of an especially diverse set of new members of Congress, for example, after 2016.
And Carrie?
Yes, I would say the shifts in the American population over the last decade has been monumental, becoming blacker and browner, not only in the general population, but as in the electorate as well. And it has the potential to cause major shifts in American politics.
And we'll see a lot more once we have the census numbers out from the 2020 census. Thank you so much to all of you four political experts here with me in studio, Deandra Rose from Duke University, Carrie Haney, also with Duke, Susan Roberts at Davidson College, and Michael Bitzer at Catawba College. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.